evidence that enslaved Muslims maintained Islamic practices for generations. In Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Muslim immigrants from Lebanon and Syria built what some consider the first mosque in America in 1934, the Mother Mosque. It's still there. These stories exist all over the country, in Dearborn, Michigan, in Minnesota, in California. Usin's just showing us what that looks like here in New York.
We can keep walking, show you some more stuff.
Usin took us uptown. Harlem has been the spiritual heart of Muslim America for decades. Malcolm X preached here in the 50s and 60s, turning this neighborhood into the origin point for Black Muslim activism. And for most of the 20th century, Black Muslims were the story of Islam in America. Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, they weren't hiding. They weren't being erased. They were speaking up, organizing, demanding to be seen and heard. Black Americans finding Islam, or returning to it, as a way to reclaim identity, to resist, to build power. The mosques here are still considered the spiritual successors to that movement. Muslims make pilgrimage to Harlem from all over the world. It's that important. But it's not just Black Muslims. South Asian Muslims, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis have been coming to Harlem since the 1920s. Now, Bangladeshis are the fastest growing immigrant group in New York. Nearly a century of community building, and now they're electing city council members. That's the long game. And here's something else I didn't know. Harlem is also where Latino Islam in America began.
We are specifically standing in front of 1717 Lex, or 1717 Lexington Avenue, which is an address that is easy to remember, which once was the former headquarters of Alianza Islamica, Inc., the Islamic Alliance, which was the first Latino Muslim organization in the country.
Puerto Rican Muslims opened the first Spanish-speaking Muslim community center back in the mid-20th century. Today, Latinos are the fastest-growing Muslim population by conversion. Neighborhood after neighborhood, community after community, Usin pulls out these buried stories. Muslims have been here since before there was a United States. Building it, living in it, mostly invisible, sometimes erased. Occasionally making trouble with dead goats. Some of us stayed invisible by choice. Some of us got erased. Some of us spoke up. But after September 11th, 2001, none of that mattered, because America decided what the Muslim story was. And we did not get a say. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Hey everyone, it's Tom Kandel from Curtain Call. This week on the show, five-time Tony Award-winning director and choreographer Susan Stroman joins me for an in-depth conversation about the craft behind Broadway's biggest moments. From Crazy for You and Contact to the record-breaking phenomenon The Producers and the powerful Scottsboro Boys, we explore what it takes to build a musical that lasts. That's Curtain Call, spotlighting the magic of theater one conversation at a time, found only at WJFFradio.org.
This is Storytellers, Muslims, Community, and Culture in America. I'm Sabine Sadiq.
So what we're looking at are panels that are a tribute to those who lost their lives on 9/11. The North Tower was.
If you've never been to the 9/11 Memorial in Manhattan, there are these two enormous pools where the towers stood. Water falls from every side into the center of these pools. The names of everyone who died are carved into marble slabs around the pools. Asad took us to one specific name.
And we're here at S66 looking at the panel of Muhammad Salman Hamdani, who was a Pakistani-American first responder, aged 23 on 9/11, had just graduated college, and the story has it that he actually was not on duty that morning. But what we think happened is that he saw that something was happening, and so he rushes downtown. And he dies at some point trying to save lives downtown. After the attack, he was reported missing. He wasn't confirmed dead yet. And so for a long time, he was believed to be a suspect.
Muhammad Salman Hamdani died trying to save people. And for months, the story about him was that he might have been a terrorist. That's what it meant to be Muslim in America after 9/11. Even if you died a hero, someone would write a different story first.
March of 2002, when his remains were finally recovered, and at that point, the entire city, including the mayor, the governor, the police commissioner, paid their respects to him and attended his funeral at the 96th Street Mosque in Harlem in the Upper East Side. He's an example of a Muslim who lost his life on the day of the attack trying to save other people and was deemed for many, many months thereafter a suspect of that same attack that took his life. Yeah. For a long time, I was not able to grieve as a New Yorker because I was so worried as a Muslim. I wasn't able to mourn properly because for a long time, I knew that my mourning or our collective mourning was being weaponized to wage wars on two Muslim countries and to surveil and to profile and to discriminate against us.
After 9/11, the story about Muslims got written. The story was suspect, terrorist, other, un-American. Didn't matter if you were trying to save lives, like Hamdani. Didn't matter if you were just a kid in Brooklyn, like Asad. The narrative was set, and you had to live inside it. This wasn't hypothetical for Asad. It was his teens. Asad then walks us up Broadway and starts to tell us what happened to him a few years after 9/11.
When I was in college, my friends and I co-founded a charity organization that was dedicated to delivering groceries and food to low-income and poor families in my neighborhood. It was a volunteer-based group, so all you had to do to participate was literally to just show up. And a young man sent me a message in March of 2012 saying he wants to get involved with some of the work that I'm doing, that he comes from a troubled past, and he just wants to ground himself in faith and community and so on.
Asad invites the guy to come on out, meet his friends, do service work. So that's what the guy does. He's a great volunteer. They become pals. He meets all Asad's friends. He sleeps at Asad's house. Asad's mom cooks for him. The guy joins Asad at his local mosque. This goes on for 7 months, until the day the guy confesses that he's been acting as an informant sent by the NYPD, the New York Police Department, to investigate terrorism.
We as a community were completely rattled, completely shaken by it.
An informant, taking notes, writing reports, literally creating a file, a story about Asad and his friends. They were just delivering groceries to families in need. But in the NYPD's view, they were potential terrorists. Someone else was writing their story. Asad gets another message. But this one is from lawyers at Clear, a legal nonprofit in Long Island City, Queens. They invite him to come to their offices and repeat the surveillance story and answer some questions about it.
And then at the end of it, they said, the reason we called you here is because we've been working on a lawsuit to challenge police surveillance, and we want you to be a plaintiff. This is going to be what is known as a class action lawsuit. So multiple parties will be involved, and we're all going to work together to sue the NYPD for what we believe is unconstitutional surveillance of Muslim communities.
Asad says all the adults in his life at that point, as a 19-year-old community college student, were cab drivers, bodega workers, teachers, security guards.
I don't even know what the hell an attorney was. And all these attorneys are making me sign forms for this lawsuit. I'm like, hang on there a second.
Asad takes a couple days to think things over. He and the lawyers talk a little more. National organizations get involved. And on June 18th, 2013, they sue the NYPD, standing on the plaza in front of police headquarters in Lower Manhattan.
I was standing here, I think, the day we launched it. Let me show you something.
Asad pulls out his phone, swipes, taps, and pulls up a photograph. You can do one of those things where you hold the screen up and line up the trees and the buildings behind, and then it looks like the people in the photo are standing right in front of you.
So there's me standing in my cheap H&M skinny tie and sport coat. To my left is Imam Hassan Raza, whom the lawsuit was named after, right? You can see Imam Talib Abdul Rashid here, the leader of the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood in Harlem.
The background is the Lower Manhattan skyline, in front of which is the entrance to the Brooklyn Bridge. It's pure New York. Just out of the frame, but squatting right next to Asad, is the NYPD headquarters.
And I very vividly remember saying, those who are supposed to protect me, and then I turned my head to the right, and I grilled the plaza where the ones harming me. That I remember. And surprisingly, I didn't cry when I spoke.
Asad and other plaintiffs sued the NYPD in 2013 for mapping Muslim communities and sending informants into mosques to spy on innocent people. They won. In 2016, a settlement forced the NYPD to stop targeting people based on religion, race, or ethnicity. And it installed a civilian watchdog to make sure they actually followed the rules. It was a huge victory for civil rights in New York.
And that is the story of how I sued the world's largest police department out of college.
Asad was 23. But here's the thing about narratives imposed from outside. They don't just go away because you win a lawsuit. Every time something happens in the Muslim world, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, the devastation of Gaza, the same pattern repeats. Muslim Americans are made to feel their grief is an inconvenience, their pain, something to be whispered rather than shared. Muslims in America become suspect again. Being seen becomes being watched. So what do? When you can't hide, when you can't stay quiet, when America keeps trying to write your story for you. Some of us decided, fine, you want to look at me? I'll tell you exactly who I am, in my own words, before you can make up your own version. We walked onto stages, and we took the microphone. When I grew up, a member of my family struggled with serious mental health issues. And sometimes conversations would get really loud, like somebody's gonna call the cops loud. which meant the neighbors knew our business, whether we wanted them to or not. They were already writing their story about us, the problem family, the scary family. And when the cops would leave, my mom would just deflate. She'd sit at the kitchen table looking like she'd just run out of gas. And the thing is, we all ran out of gas, and there was no space or energy for my voice and my needs to be heard. There wasn't much we could do. I couldn't make the neighbors stop staring, but I could try to make my mom smile. So the next time the cops pulled up in our driveway, I was like, oh, let me go put on some makeup. I think that's Officer Dan, you know? And I was 14. What was I supposed to do? And my mom cackled. And when she laughed, I felt like I cracked some kind of code. Here's the thing, humor, it can cut through so much pain, just for a second, just enough. And I got obsessed with it. What makes people laugh? How do you take something heavy and make it not lighter exactly, but make it yours? Eventually, I gave myself entirely to stand-up. Open mics constantly. I mean, you have to be a little crazy in the beginning and middle and now. And here's what happened. I started telling jokes about my life, my family, my neuroses. And at some point throughout all of this, I realized I'm Muslim too. That's part of my life. That's part of the story. And I had a choice. I could keep being a secret Muslim, let people assume whatever they wanted, or I could say it first, define it myself, tell them what it means before they could decide for me.
Yo, this is a good night. How's everyone doing? Yeah.
Stand-up is permission. Permission to say, here's who I am. You're going to listen for 7 minutes. And if you don't like it, I'm going to go home and cry for a minute. But hey, there was a 2-drink minimum, so I'm getting paid.
Okay, let's get to know each other. I'm a Muslim person. Any of those? Nope. Okay, cool. But yeah, no, I'm a Muslim person. I'm more on the religious side. Just wanted to say that to kill the energy. Okay.
Most of the time, people don't know I'm Muslim until I tell them. They're just like, who's this ambiguous Latina girl? And then I watch them fix their faces in real time.
So I'll say things like, me? I'm just spiritual. They'll be like, Sabine, don't you pray? And I'm like, yeah, meditate. 5 times a day in a really specific direction.
Yasmeen El-Hadi, you know, the comedian and lawyer from Alabama? The one who stood up to bullies with mashed potatoes? She found comedy early, too.
I had a very strong inner world. I finally, like, just made peace with the fact that no one was going to talk to me and that I was going to be kind of forgotten. I remember watching Saturday Night Live a lot as a kid, and mm-hmm. it, like, lit me up.
Oh, I
it just
that.
Lit me up.
How old were you when you, when
I was,
you watched it?
I was 7, 6.
Not to make her mom laugh, not to cut through the trauma, just because it lit her up.
I would do SNL skits by myself in the corner. I would just run the skit. I would be, you know, Sherry O'Terry and Will Ferrell. I would do Chris Farley.
In a van down by the river.
I would do David Spade.
Thanks for flying with us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
For me, it feels like therapy. It feels like a pure form of joy and connection. I think everything I've ever done, I've actually wanted to seek connection, but I kind of turned inward because I didn't feel like my bids for connection were received.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that when I'm on stage, I feel like people can see themselves and then I see myself too. And I love that.
But Yasmeen realized comedy could do something bigger than just help her survive.
As time went on, I was like, man, the comedy is important and bigger stages are important because it helps people expand their mind of what could be possible for a Muslim woman. And then what it does, too, for, I think, other Muslims is that it just expands also their permission to be themselves out loud. And then for non-Muslims, what it feels like is expansive. And it helps them understand what are the possibilities of what a Muslim could look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that expansion is a heart expansion. And it happens in a way that is so disarming because it's comedy. And yet your heart is expanding because you are listening and you're connecting to the words that are being said in a way that is not trying to preach to you or teach you, or it's not didactic.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's collaborative. It's inviting. It's warm, and sometimes it's biting, but in a way where your defenses are down, so you're listening.
And I'm like, what do you mean? I am one of them. I'm Muslim. She's like, no, you're not one of them. You're not as deep as them. I was like, deep? Like, I'm not as poetic as other Muslims. I'm not as religious as other Muslims. I'm not as philosophical. I can't read Tolstoy, but who can? What does she mean by this? She's like, you're not as deep as them. And then she winks at me like it was some kind of secret thing between me and her, me and crazy lady. And she touched her face, and I was like, do you mean I'm not black enough to be Muslim? And she's like, you said it, not me. I know. And in that moment, I was like, I have white privilege. Only my friends in Alabama could see me now.
A few years ago, Yasmin got offered the biggest platform she'd ever had, the chance to host a reality dating show for Muslims on Hulu, owned by Disney. Millions of viewers. No pressure. But it was a chance to tell Muslim stories, specifically Muslim women's stories about love and family and faith on her own terms. Not as victims, not as stereotypes, just as people trying to find someone who'll put up with them. You know, like everyone else. The first season of Muslim Matchmaker aired last year.
The critics definitely get it. And in interviews that I've had with people, I think they kind of are like, oh, this is the only dating show that makes me smarter. Like, I'm not dumber after watching this show. I've learned a ton.
Whoa.
Yeah, which is kind of cool. And so it's kind of an elevated conversation. And that's not for everybody. Like, not everyone loves a dating show where they're learning, you know?
Yeah, I think people watch dating shows for, like, the mess of it all.
Yes.
And then, like, and you're just like, let's be healed and find love. And they're like, what?
Yeah. What do you mean? Not more than one person, and we don't have to run the gauntlet and have challenges, and at the end, everyone's forced to get married. What do you mean it's not blind dating and blind love and meet me at the altar? Like, it's some crazy abusive stuff that's going on reality dating TV, and everyone's like, this is normal. Let's watch the train wreck.
Yasmin's show is basically the opposite of swiping right. You actually have to talk to people. Revolutionary, I know. But here's what's interesting about that show and about Yasmin doing it. She's helping people navigate what it means to be a Muslim finding love in modern America. And part of that is pushing back against the idea that Islam is inherently restrictive, especially for women. Because actually, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was arguably kind of radical for his time when it came to women's rights.
He's a 25-year-old that marries a 40-year-old woman. Widowed twice.
And people really don't like to
talk
about that.
Widowed twice with at least three kids. The scholars debate about how many kids she had. Minimum three kids.
Oh, wow.
All right? There's a 15-year gap between... He's doing everything that is taboo today. Mm-hmm. He's doing that over 1,400 years ago.
Yasmin's not just hosting a dating show. She's writing a different story about what Islam is, who Muslim women are, what's possible. And that comes with a cost. You can't just show up and be yourself. You have to be yourself and represent 1.8 billion people and not reinforce stereotypes and be funny and make it look easy. Can somebody get her a Nobel Peace Prize? Sometimes you just want to tell a joke about your mom without it becoming a think piece. But that's the trade-off. You get to control your narrative, but you have to do it in front of everyone, loudly, knowing some people will hate it. Maybe hate you. That's the cost of holding a mic. So here's where we are now. Asad was spied on as a teenager for delivering groceries to families in need. And now, there's a landmark legal decision that protects people of all faiths and backgrounds from being surveilled. Yasmin was bullied in Alabama for wearing hijab. Now, she's on Hulu, redefining what Muslim women's stories look like. Me? I was a secret Muslim who spent recess smashing rocks. Now, I'm narrating this documentary.
Say mashallah. Right now. Say it. Thank you. Muslims have been in America since before there was a United States. And for most of that time, other people got to decide what our story was, or if we got a story at all. Now we're writing it ourselves. And then there's our guy, Zoran Mamdani, you might have heard. In November of 2025, he was elected mayor of New York City, the first Muslim mayor of New York, the first Muslim mayor of any major American city. Last year, when he was still campaigning, Mamdani said something that stuck with me.
You know, part of the reason I'm sitting before you as the Democratic nominee is because of an increase in Muslim voter turnout unlike anything we've ever seen in the history of the city. And the reason that was so difficult, the reason it's taken so long, one of those reasons is that there are many whose experiences in the post 9/11 era, whose experiences have taught them that the safest place to be is in the shadows.
The safest place to be is in the shadows. He's right. For a long time, that was the deal. Stay quiet. Don't give anyone a reason to look at you. Let them write whatever story they want, as long as they leave you alone. I did it. Asad was supposed to do it. Yasmin's dad wanted her to do it. But most of us aren't doing it anymore. We're walking onto stages, making TV shows, leading tours, running for office, getting elected, writing our own stories, representing the culture in a way that's not negative.
Okay, I'm going to do it just because I really shouldn't be up too late. Okay, I'll get the Yemeni latte. Hot, please. Let's do iced. We're getting crazy.
Last Ramadan, at that Kawa house in Brooklyn, my friends and I sat around drinking chai and eating a dessert called kanafa, so good, talking about our lives, our families, our ridiculous attempts at dating. We were Muslim, visibly, obviously Muslim, in public during Ramadan.
It feels very Ramadan in here.
And nobody was taking notes, nobody was deciding what it meant, nobody was writing a file about us. We were just being us. That's not nothing. That's everything. This has been Storytellers, Muslims, Community, and Culture in America from APM American Public Media, hosted by me, Sabine Siddiq. Storytellers was produced by Dan O'Donnell. Ida Alami was our reporting lead. Executive produced by Mary Stuckey for Round Earth Media, a program of the International Women's Media Foundation. The show was mixed by Aaron Dalton. Reporting for this project was supported by a grant from the Doris Duke Foundation. Our music is by Palestine-born New York-based musician Firas Zraik from his album Salute. Very special thanks to Abdi Latif Aiga. You can listen to this program again by visiting iwmf.org. I'm Sabine Siddiq. Thank you for listening.
Caregiving for a loved one can be stressful. The Caregiver Resource Center is here to help, offering information and referrals, support groups, and workshops. A co-partnership between Cornell Cooperative Extension and the Office for the Aging of Sullivan County, the center also offers exercise and educational programs for seniors. Information at sullivancce.org/events. Supported by a grant from the New York State Department of Health and the Alzheimer's Association.
On the next Radiolab.
I kind of love this guy.
The story of a senator.
His first name is Birch.
Birch Bayh.
His last name is Bayh.
A very ambitious senator.
He was a problem solver.
Birch Bayh got a lot done.
The 25th Amendment.
Title IX.
Who almost abolished the Electoral College.
It's outdated. It's unfair.
The person with the most votes should win.
And it is a ticking time bomb.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville,
This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.